Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, and thank you all for joining us. I'm going to try to give an overview, not just of the subject of judicial reform, but of the political response to it, which I think is the more surprising and alarming part of the story. But in order to understand what's going on, I think we have to take a step back and look at the history of how we got here. And to understand it, we have to begin at the very beginning of the Israeli legal system, the founding of Israel. Israel, at its founding, did not adopt a written constitution. It was one of the things that was imagined as an instant yes, that there would be a constitution. The first elections in Israel were not for the parliament, were not for the Knesset. They were for a constitutional assembly that was going to draft a constitution. But Ben-Gurion was not interested in one. There were two wide gaps between the various sides. And he thought it was perfectly fine to go on the way England did, which was with a Westminster parliamentary democracy with parliamentary supremacy. And that's what Israel had from its founding, more or less until the 1990s. Now, in the initial system, as it was set up by Israel's founders and especially by Ben-Gurion, there was a very activist Supreme Court. The court found its road to activism through the British parliamentary supremacy system, which meant that it could not address legislation of the Knesset. That was out of reach of the court. But it could address administrative or executive action. And in the 1950s, the court, in a series of decisions, announced that it would interpret all legislation of the Knesset to implicitly require that all executive authorities respect human rights in their actions. Maybe the most famous of these decisions is from 1953 in the Kol Ha'am decision. The court interpreted the newspaper licensing authority not to permit the shutting down of a pro-Stalinist paper that had criticized Ben-Gurion for not being sufficiently nice to Joseph Stalin. And that's that was fairly uncontroversial and stood that way until there was a revolution in Israel's legal system that was led primarily by one man, Aaron Barak. Aaron Barak ascended to the Supreme Court in 1978 after serving as Attorney General. He remained on the court until 2006. He became president of the court in 1995. He was self-consciously a revolutionary, and he remade the Israeli legal system from end to end. Among the things that he did is he declared there was a constitutional revolution and that Israel actually had a constitution after all. It was not a standard written constitution, and it didn't appear to have any fixed content. It was those principles that the court identified from time to time as constitutional that were never fully articulated. On the basis of this constitution, Barak announced that the court now had the right to overturn Knesset legislation. But he also made other far-reaching changes in the legal system. He changed the role of all government legal advisors. He made them commissars instead of advisors so that they could overturn the decisions of elected officials, speaking in the name of the law, which didn't mean, of course, anything that was enacted by the Knesset, but was an abstraction that could not be seen by ordinary human beings, but could be discerned by expert lawyers who were sitting on the bench. He eliminated all barriers to people getting into court, things like standing and justiciability and the standard barriers one sees in democracies to bringing disputes to the. I was going through the various changes that Barak made in the court's powers. So I said that he introduced a judicial review over legislation. He turned legal advisors into legal commissars. He invited all political disputes to the court by eliminating all procedural barriers, such as standing justiciability. He gave the court the power to get involved in political debates and have the final word by introducing something he called reasonableness review, which he meant that if an executive authority exercised their discretionary authority, if they exercised their discretion in a manner that was manifestly unreasonable, according to the court, that is, by making a decision that an enlightened, reasonable person, like Barak, would consider to be the wrong one, the court would overturn it, which brought the court to some bizarre points where, for example, it would announce that it was manifestly unreasonable for a minister not to decide to resign immediately because some scandal had arisen, or it was manifestly unreasonable to grant a prize to so-and-so because he hadn't apologized for something, or it was it's manifestly unreasonable to have this percentage tax on cigarettes and a different percentage tax on rolling tobacco. Every possible issue you can imagine came into reasonableness review. And of course, there were alongside those these administrative and public law issues, there were changes in every other field of law, in criminal law and private law. This was remarked upon already at the very beginning of Barak's term in the 1980s by figures like Manny Mautner, who was at Tel Aviv University, is at Tel Aviv University. I think he's emeritus now. And it was highly controversial. It was highly controversial in the legal community and in the academy, but it wasn't controversial in the court. It wasn't controversial in the court because one final thing that Barak did was he seized control of the appointments process. The appointments process in Israel, judges are appointed by a professional committee. Originally, the law stated that judges were appointed by the government and approved by the Knesset, but that was changed in 1953. The professional committee is comprised of three judges from the Supreme Court, two members of the bar, two government ministers, one member of the parliament from the majority and one from the opposition. And Barak instituted an informal process by which the Supreme Court justices voted as a block, which these days gives them a formal veto over any appointments. Supreme Court justices have to be appointed by 7 out of 9, which means if the 3 Supreme Court justices vote no, it's no. And even more importantly, Barak was the person who decided to take control of the tenor of the appointments, which no one had done previously, and no one, frankly, did until much later. There was a brief attempt by Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked a few years ago to do so, and she ended up cutting some deals with the Supreme Court at that time. But it meant that the court consisted entirely of people who were like-minded on the question of activism, of judicial activism. They were all 100% behind Barak's approach. And this meant that Barak's decisions ended up being not just a majority, but supermajority in the court, notwithstanding the fact that they were quite controversial. Now, there was a logic behind Barak's approach. Barak had a different conception of what the role of governments and the court is in a democracy. He's profoundly skeptical of politics and of common people. He extols what he calls the enlightened public. The ordinary public's of less interest to him. At the same time, Barak is quite confident about the moral stature of judges and lawyers. This means that Barak more or less instituted a platonic guardianship in place of an ordinary democracy. Instead of decisions being made primarily by elected officials, they're made by elected officials subject to the oversight of the aristos, the best, right? Barak had a terminology by which he explained that this was the true, better, substantive democracy. It may not look like democracy, but it's real true substantive democracy. And he felt the need to explain why this was legitimate in a parliamentary democracy. But over time, the court forgot all that and just assumed that it had the superior authority. Now, all of the judicial reform, the entirety of it, is about Barak's changes to the legal system and attempts to undo those. All of the proposed changes in the reform, with one exception, have to do with particular doctrines that were adopted by Barak. The one exception is the appointments process. The only reform that doesn't deal directly with a proposed with a doctrine, Barak, is a proposed change, or there are several different versions of it. Proposed changes to the appointments process that would create the ability to balance appointments in the court and end the control of activist judges over the appointments process. Now, I think that my opinion is, as Asaf says, I've been involved in this issue for some years. When I clerked in the court, I would jokingly refer to Barak as the philosopher king. I was not the only person who did so. I've thought that reform has been necessary for some time. I think that Barak's changes were ill-advised. And they were ill-advised on a number of grounds. The basic grounds, first of all, I think that democracy is a wise system, and a system that not only is good in principle, but achieves a number of goals. It respects the autonomy of the individuals who are trying to choose their form of government. It forces compromise between different parts of society, which doesn't happen when the courts take over issues. You can see this, for example, in the ongoing battle over the draft of ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel, where, for better or for worse, there have been political compromises over the years when the court took the power to overturn legislation. It got rid of those compromises. It has not been able to successfully institute an alternative way of dealing with the issue. I also think that the Barak changes undermine the rule of law. Ultimately, the rule of law is based on a uniform application of the rules to everyone, and respect for the law as made by the procedures established in law. Barak's system is one of unbridled discretion of the judges to do almost anything that they want. I shouldn't say almost anything. They can do anything that they want. This leads to politicization of the court. Every political issue goes to the court, and the court institutes its own political policy. And there's definitely a political flavor to the decisions from the Supreme Court over the years. It's not an accident that groups that are today associated with the right, the ultra-Orthodox religious Jews, Mizrahi Jews, feel that they're given short shrift. They are. The court's enforcement of basic rights is somewhat selective. Right, so you have some decisions that are truly shocking, like the court deciding in the name of competition to shut down the Arut Sheva radio station because there may come a day in the future when there are no radio frequencies left, and it will be necessary to have the particular frequency of Arut Sheva in order to have free competition. And finally, I think that anyone who is skeptical about government power and believes that absolute power corrupts has to look at a system where the Supreme Court has declared for itself unlimited power. Without a written constitution, the Israeli Supreme Court is the only Supreme Court in the Western world, in the democratic world, that overturns legislation. Without a written constitution, it does so without any guidelines, right? It makes up the rules by which it then overturns laws. And if you believe that absolute power corrupts, this is a system that's inherently unstable and over time will break down. I believe we're already seeing it breaking down. Now, there of course is opposition to reform. The main opposition to the reform over the years has been from those empowered by Barak's system, the Supreme Court justices, other justices, the legal advisors, lawyers and law professors who hope to benefit from that system, and those who believe themselves benefited by the political inclinations of the court, which tends to be more on the left. That said, I have to say that over the years, calls for judicial reform have come both from the right and the left. They haven't come only from one side of the political spectrum. Now, there's also those who agree with Barak that democracy and politics are suspect, that perhaps in other countries, democracy is okay, but Israel really needs platonic guardians. And they would say, especially now, and this is because they have a profound fear of the makeup of the current coalition, not the per se the politicians, but more the voting groups that are behind them, religious Jews, particularly ultra-Orthodox Jews and Mizrahim. That's the primary ethnic groups that are behind the current coalition. And there's a fear, especially among left-leaning secular Ashkenazis, that the demographics of the country have changed so that it will be a permanent majority for the religious Jews and the Mizrahim. I think that's wrong, but that's their fear. And in such a situation, it's dangerous to have majority rule. It's much, much better to have enlightened platonic guardians. And that's the essential debate about reform, or at least it ought to be. And this brings me to the last point, which is the debate you've been hearing is not between the two sides of those who support the reform because of what's in it and those who oppose the reform because of what's in it. Those who support reform because they want to revive Israeli democracy as it was practiced before Barak, and those who oppose it because they like the aristocratic sheen on Israeli democracy that was created by Barak. Now, instead, what we're having is a completely dishonest public debate in which the side that supports aristocracy over democracy, that supports the platonic guardianship, argues that it's in favor of democracy, whereas we're told that the side that is trying to restore the primacy of parliament and elected officials and majority rule is actually autocratic, dictatorial, fascist, Nazi. You hear claims that we have to maintain the current system of unlimited power for the court because limited government is essential. You hear the argument that we have to maintain the complete and unbounded discretion of the court to interfere in all issues and not on the basis of the law, because that keeps the rule of law, whereas actually restoring the rule of law as it's understood in the scholarly literature is the destruction of the rule of law and ends judicial independence. And you have this fake history in which everything that happened before Barak is disposed of, so that you have opponents of the reform insisting that if the reform passes, then it'll put Israel in a situation which has never been before, whereas anyone with a legal education in Israel knows that Israel had a good 40-something years before Barak's reforms took hold. Right? The judicial reform is a partial restoration of what Israel used to have. Now, that's not the worst part of the debate. The worst part is not simply its dishonesty. I think that the worst part of the debate is the actions that accompany it. Protesters against the judicial reform, and by the way, they include some very, very senior officials, like Aaron Barak himself, who's now retired, former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, former Chiefs of Staff, former Bank of Israel officials, etc., have gone so far as to encourage people to pull their investments from Israel. They've encouraged reservists not to report for duty. They've encouraged the very kinds of things that I think left and right in Israel have united over the years in fighting the attempt to coerce Israeli policy through the creation of international double standards on matters like how we understand law. And here you have the opponents of the reform trying to distort the meaning of the word democracy in order to paint Israel as a non-democratic state. Now, this is going to cause permanent damage. This is not going to go away. When senior officials from Israel say that the state is no longer democratic, then you can bet that opponents of the existence of Israel will be quoting that forever after. And any subsequent political compromise about the nature of judicial reform will not undo that. And then there's another aspect to the destructive efforts of the anti-reform protesters, and that is the attempt to bully, in some cases violently, and personally, supporters of the reform, not only those in public office, but also those in the academy and elsewhere. I know that I made the mistake of expressing publicly my belief that the judicial reform is a good idea. And I've been subject to various forms of verbal and nonverbal bullying, some of them coming from within the academy. I have there's a colleague of mine in Tel Aviv University, who I've known for many years, who wrote to me saying that I'm destroying the country, but it's okay, there's still a chance to repent. Now, there have been threats of violence. There have been attempts to describe organizations, one of them with which I'm affiliated, the Qohelet Policy Forum, as secret cabals like the Elders of Zion that are controlling public debate and using insidious mind control and money to undermine the country and force it into an autocracy. We were at a point where the anti-reform efforts have crossed lines that I don't know can be uncrossed. And I think this, more importantly, is perhaps even more important now than judicial reform. I think the judicial reform is vital to restore Israeli democracy. But the anti-reform efforts have exposed Israel to attack on many fronts that I don't know what the resolution is. I don't know how to defend Israel anymore against the kinds of damage that they've done. And I have to say, I have one final fear, and with that I'll close and let Saf take this over. The court and its allies have openly threatened that if the reform passes, the court will simply disregard it and announce it unconstitutional. On the grounds that the court identifies some invisible basic principles that it has just identified at the moment for the purposes of that case that deny the Knesset the ability to limit the jurisdiction of the judiciary. Now, if that happens, that will be a constitutional crisis the likes of which we've never seen before, because the court will take actions and the government will take actions. The government will be following the law. The court will be following its own decision. And we already have a background where we have army commanders, police commanders, et cetera, that have announced that they do not view the passage of laws by an elected parliament as democracy. Now, democracy is what the Platonic Guardians say, and it's not clear from whom they're going to take orders. And when some individual decides that the doomsday scenarios of the anti-reform protesters are real, and that democracy is going to be destroyed if there's a parliamentary Westminster system in Israel, and they decide to take matters into their own hands by using a gun, as, by the way, many have already threatened to do, it's not clear how the police will react. It's not clear how the army will react. This is an extremely dangerous situation. And on that pessimistic note, let me turn it back to you, Asaf.
Great. Well, thank you for all of that, Avi, and you know, appreciate you unpacking what is a very complex and a very ongoing issue in Israel that we're watching every day. So I appreciate you unpacking and for the erudite explanation for where we are now. There are obviously a lot of questions, and of course, you know, anybody who has questions, please type in your questions via the chat. Alex, why don't you start us off, and then we will go from there with the audience.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks, I think, for a comprehensive and comprehensively depressing kind of analysis. My initial reaction is that it's 5 o'clock somewhere, and I'm going to find that bar.
there you go.
Which I think is the mature adult thing to do. I'm struck, of course, by the ironic implications of your analysis, that this idea that a constitution-less society nevertheless has a kind of internally generated constitution, which is a living document, so to speak. And that the court is an autonomous as an autonomous entity that can be that must be respected and you know, placed not on equal footing with other branches of government, but it, you know, from the American perspective, these are all, now that we're enjoying another round of Supreme Court delegitimization, I'm struck by these contrasts and harmonies or disharmonies. But to go back to Aaron Barak himself and his, well, what you described as a kind of aristocratic orientation, Platonic viewpoint. What are the sources of this? Where did he ground his theory? I read an analysis from a number of years ago by Richard Posner of the University of Chicago, which took Barak to task precisely about these kinds of issues. But philosophically, legally, one might say, where does this come from internally?
Barak is a unique man. He's a very, very, very smart individual. His judicial philosophy is his own. He's written it up in several places. To critics like me, it's incoherent, but that doesn't mean he doesn't believe in it. He cherry picks the elements that he likes from various places. So he'll tell you that it's based on, let's say, Ronald Dworkin's writings, but it's not. And he'll say that there are elements he took from Hans Kelsen, but he didn't. There's vast gaps between way he understood and what understands things and the way they understood things. The essence of his philosophy is it's a unique conception of law. He's described the law as being omnipresent. He describes it in terms that religious people would use to refer to the deity, right? He describes the law as being everywhere and governing everything. And he doesn't look at it as something that is made by elected officials. He looks at the law as being something that is out there that judges, uniquely judges, can discern. Now that's a natural law philosophy that goes back several hundred years, but even then, I don't think that there's ever been anyone who's quite articulated it in the judicial supremacist terms that Barak has used.
So it's sort of the law as the Shekhinah. It's everywhere.
There's actually a verse from the Bible that he repurposed, where the verse from the Bible is that the world is full of His glory, and Barak has in one of it, he changed the wording slightly, and the world is full of law.
Great. Alex, a follow-up, or we'll come back to you? I just want to get
let's go on and take more questions. Thanks.
We will get back to you, and there's a lot to discuss about that, the aura of and the holiness, Avi. Let me go to our friend and colleague Shlomo Dubnov, Avi, who you know well, who is asking. So there's been a bunch of publications, obviously, in Israel. He's pointing to Haaretz in the recent book, talking about the role of the IDF's opposition to the reform, not only on the reservist side, but also the larger phenomena within IDF, former military people, former intel people, which you touched on in your talk. But he wants you to go a little bit deeper, I would say, here. In terms of the legal aspects, you know, the separation of authorities and the roles of the executive branch, how does it play out within the current Israeli debate, within the role of the IDF being, I would say, supposed to be apolitical? And, why is the military taking questions of reform into their professional consideration? You know, where do we draw the line, I would say, between obviously security needs and, this is a political debate. And so this is not the most question here, if you could tackle that.
Yeah, so Israel has always been a bureaucratic state that is a state with a very, very strong independent bureaucracy that only partially listens to the authorities above it, and this goes back to the days of one-party rule in Israel, where Ben Gurion set up the various bureaucracies to be extensions of the workers' union, which he controlled, the Histadrut, and it was through the bureaucracies and workers' committees that Ben-Gurion was able to exclude his political rivals, whom he did not exclude from running for office, right? So Begin and the predecessors of the Likud, Chirut, and et cetera, ran for office, ended up with membership in the Knesset. But in the bureaucracy, they couldn't get jobs, right? They couldn't get jobs because they didn't have the red card of membership in the labor-dominated Histadrut. Now, one of the things that Barak did, or that Barak's court did, and his successors carried that on, was to try to maintain this independent power of the bureaucracy, the independent power of the army, the independent power of other bureaucracies in Israel, there's some logic to it. That is, it makes sense that, for example, you don't want policing to be overly politicized. That you want to some degree for police to be able to make professional decisions, or prosecutors to be able to make professional decisions, or the army to be able to make professional decisions. But ultimately, the policy decisions have to be made by someone. It seems obvious to me that in a democracy, they have to be made by the elected officials. That's not who it's obvious to in the anti-reform crowd. and in the court. To them, these decisions, the policy decisions, can be divided up into two kinds. There are political decisions, which are bad and should have no effect. And there are policy decisions which are professional and should be made by the bureaucrats with the oversight only of the legal advisors and the court. And you're seeing, therefore, the highest echelons of the bureaucracies, the Bank of Israel, right, the bank regulators, the health officials, and the army, are all more or less declaring that in this battle, they are with the court, they're with the legal advisors, and therefore they're with themselves, with their own unreviewable power, rather than respecting elected authorities. And that is extremely, extremely dangerous. Now, this is not new to the battle over reform. This is something that is a result of Barak's changes, and it has happened over the years. And so it's been reported now that a number of years ago, in one of Netanyahu's earlier terms as prime minister, he ordered the army to prepare for, make preparations for a potential attack on Iran's nuclear program. And more or less, the army refused. right? Senior officials said, we'll have to check and get legal advice first before we can know whether we're going to obey that order. And this is alarming, right? You can see why the prime minister is not too eager to make a large point of this, but I'm sure the Iranians have noticed that they don't necessarily have to fear a political decision to carry out an attack on their nuclear program when it may not be carried out at all. This is a very, very dangerous situation. It's one of the reasons why judicial reform is absolutely necessary. This can't go on.
Great, thank you. So as a segue to your last point, Richard Fulton is asking a question about the concept of checks and balances. I mean, you know, the fact that that there is a question about how to have a check-in on the Knesset, and does it have to be an all-or-nothing situation? And he's referring to the British system that has been as a mode of comparison here. Is that something that should be compared to what Israel is trying to do? What are your thoughts on that?
So I mean I think there's a lot of wisdom to the American system, where there's a checks and balances and separation of powers. The essential idea was to set up a competition between the various democratically elected branches, through federalism and multi-camera legislature and the president. It's worth noting that the Federalist Papers were written about a constitution that did not contain a Bill of Rights. Right? The founding fathers did not conceive of checks and balances as encompassing freewheeling judicial review of legislation to protect human rights. That was just not part of the picture. But the Israeli system is different. The Israeli system was traditionally based on the British system, where the primary check on the power of the government is the parliament. That is, the parliament can bring down any government for lack of confidence. In Israel, this is a good deal more significant than it is in Britain, and that's because Israel has always had proportional representation in the Knesset, which means that no party has ever won a majority of the seats of the Knesset. Every government has always been a coalition, and for that reason, governments do not last long. I think there's an average of 1.5 governments for every Knesset election. They're always on the edge. And that means that a government that steps out too far will fall. And that is a tremendously successful formula in curbing extremism. And the irony of this is that Barak's changes undermine that. The Barak's changes more or less make it so that that's one way. Coalitions of the left have little to worry about, but coalitions of the right are under more or less constant attack by the legal advisors and the court, constantly being told that they can't do various things. And it's not just that, it's also the court, in order to do this, has seized for itself powers that are completely unlimited. There's no check on the court. There's no bound on the court. The court does not obey the law, it creates the law. The way the court understands it, the law is not what is passed by the Knesset. It is not what is enacted in regulations by the government. The law is something that's out there that the judges uniquely identify in different ways from time to time. So it seems to me that if you think that limited government is important and that checks and balances are important, you ought to support judicial reform. Now, one of the supreme ironies here is that before the last elections, Benny Gantz, who's the head of one of the opposition parties that opposes judicial reform, proposed a change to the parliamentary system in Israel. He delivered these remarks in a party meeting at the Israel Democracy Institute, and he said basically wanted to eliminate the ability of the Knesset to bring down a government on no confidence. That is, he wanted to eliminate perhaps the central checking power within the Israeli system. And now Benny Gantz is out there with the rest of the anti-reformers saying that we need to block reform because of checks and balances, separation of powers. I think that this is rhetoric that's invoked by a lot of people without seriously thinking about what it is that they're saying.
Great. Thank you for that. So there have been a bunch of questions. I'm going to try to combine them, but the common denominator really relates to the nature and the adaptation of the Constitution. What does a Constitution, an Israeli Constitution, actually look like? We've had on this, on this series of conversations, we recently had Neil Regashevsky and Martin Kramer talk about the fact that the Declaration of Independence has the makings and the ingredients of what a constitution would look like in Israel. But what are your thoughts about the Constitution? How would it look like? How would it address the rights of the people and the government and the courts? I mean, how do you see that? And is that, to your mind, I'm adding here, is that, within where the status of the reforms are, is that the natural next step as far as where this is all going, to establish that?
I think that it'll be very, very difficult to get to a constitution. Now, there are still all the original problems that were faced back when Ben-Gurion pulled the plug on the constitution making enterprise, which is that there are significant disagreements between the different segments of the population, and it's not clear how to answer them, how to reach a compromise that will be acceptable to everyone. But there's a new problem that's been created, and this is one I don't know how to answer at all. And it is that when the court invented its own constitution in the 1990s, and proceeded to strike down legislation with clear partisan flavor, and it proceeded even to strike down the very things that 5 minutes ago it had identified as being constitutional, it created a loss of confidence in the idea of constitutionalism in a vast segment of the public. I'm trying to remember who it was that said it. I believe it was a member of, Derry or some other member of Shas that said that if they proposed the Bible as the constitution, Shas would vote against it. And the idea is that no matter what the content of a constitution, if there's a court like this that's the enforcer of it, the court can't be trusted. Can't be trusted. The Constitution won't help. It will hurt. And unless there is some kind of reform in the powers of the court, and one that we can see is actually working, I don't see how we can then move on to get a working constitution. I think a working constitution is a wonderful idea. And I think that maybe after all this business is done, a larger amount of the Israeli public will see the wisdom of trying to settle these big existential issues in some kind of compromise that sets them aside for a generation or two, and setting up institutions that aren't so easily manipulated. But that includes taking care of the overall and unlimited power of the court to change constitutional law any way that it wants. And so as long as it can do that, no constitution is going to get us out of this.
Great. Thank you. Alex, I know you have a follow-up.
Sure. It's a difficult question. You've mentioned, and I think we're all aware of the near uniformity of opposition to the proposed reforms, and as you noted, the impact that it's had politically and economically, and promises to have more. Economists, entrepreneurs, people from inside and especially outside the security infrastructures, and lots of common, so to speak, people. And to be fair, hundreds of thousands of people in all parts of the country come out every Saturday night and wave flags in opposition to these proposed reforms. So my question really is, given not only the self-identified elites, but the generalized opposition, which is measurable in hundreds of thousands in the streets, are we looking at an issue of social classes in opposition, or are we really looking at a phenomenon where regular people are legitimately afraid of the extremists in the current government, who have proposed all sorts of extreme and not infrequently repulsive legislation? So what are we looking at?
I think that that you're right, that there's a battle about or let me put it this way, the majority of the opposition that we're seeing in the streets, in the academy, among entrepreneurs and others, is an opposition to particular figures in this government who they view as extreme and dangerous. And the issue by which they've decided to address this is judicial reform. Now, it's not a crazy way to address it, because it is true in the following sense, that if Israel continues to slide along in its current direction of eroding democracy in favor of judicial aristocracy, and a judicial aristocracy of its current political makeup, that current political makeup is opposed to this government. And this government will be able to do much less if we continue with the platonic guardianship of the current judges. And so it's not a crazy link that they're making between the issues. That said, there are extremists in every government. And one of the things, one of the illusions that we have is, when we look at it from a partisan view, we tend to exaggerate the importance of the extremists and the governments that we oppose, and see the centrist tendencies of the governments that we support. So it was part of the rhetoric of the during the last government, which was, as you know, ideologically opposed to this one. Opponents of that government would focus on the extremists, people like Yair Golan, who have said and done some pretty awful things. They viewed it as the end of the world. Now, the truth is, if you follow a legislative activity in the Knesset, there are thousands in every session of idiotic bills that are proposed that never go anywhere. I think we've reached now more than 200. So we can now say hundreds of idiotic bills in the current Knesset that will go nowhere. It's very hard to pass legislation. The idea that that it's necessary to have a platonic guardianship, that we have to give up democracy in Israel in order to block this particular group of crazies, I think is wrong and dangerous. I think that democracy in Israel is potentially quite healthy, and the majority of the Israeli public is and will remain liberal. And I think that it's completely irresponsible of those who have the public's ear to gin up a panic that they have to block judicial reform and stop the restoration of Israeli democracy, lest Israel turn into Iran or Israel become what they call a halachic state, that is right, a state that replaces the law with religious law and the like. None of those things are going to happen. This is just a panic mongering for purposes of political campaign, and it has consequences. It's absolutely true that when you go out on the streets and you look at the people who are protesting against, there are people protesting for as well, but the people who are protesting against reforms, I think they genuinely believe that as they're holding up their signs for democracy, they really think that the platonic guardianship they're defending is the real democracy. And it's because I think they may not understand the ins and outs of the issues, but people they trust have told them to believe this. And I think we have to ask the people that they trust why they have ginned up this panic and misled the public in this way, because it has very, very dangerous consequences.
Great. So I have a follow-up to that question, Avi, and I know our time is coming short, but let me try to, on that last note that you mentioned, and you were talking about the domestic issues of what's happening on the streets. You have the unique vantage point of looking at Israeli society and also at American society. All of this is amplified, what we're seeing on this side of the Atlantic, the schisms between the American Jewish community and the Israeli community as a result of the hysterics that we're seeing this far on both sides of the aisle. What are your thoughts? I mean, some of the way this has always been sold to the American Jewish community, and where you're seeing left and right politics play into the pro and against reform. Your thoughts on all of that. I mean, and how to address some of this. I mean, there have been many jurists, which I'm sure other people, I'm sure like Erwin Kotler and Alan Dershowitz, are all commenting about the nature of the reform and is it sustainable, is it not? What's your take on all of this?
Okay, well, I've spoken to several of the people involved in this, including the people that you mentioned.
Yeah.
I don't want to attach this to particular names, but my general impression is that they jumped in not fully knowing the issues and have now said things that maybe it would be best that they hadn't said, but it's not really possible to go back and undo them. I think that there was one of the early decisions by the opposition to reform was to try to recruit the American Jewish public and other non-Israeli actors to jump in on the debate. They did so by presenting their case in a certain way, I think in a dishonest way. By presenting their cases, basically you have a bunch of ayatollahs that are going to destroy Israeli democracy unless you fight judicial reform. I think that a lot of people decided, not a majority by any means, but significant people decide they have to come, step in and do something because they don't want to see Israel turn into a dictatorship or an autocracy or an illiberal state. And now all that's been done, right? It's It's a terrible development. I don't know how to undo it. All I can say is from the non-Israeli side of things, it's worth thinking now about perhaps your initial impressions were not correct, whether you support or oppose. And maybe you need to learn a little bit more about these issues before you jump in and make comments. This is it's legitimate to be a part of the debate, but let's understand that ultimately the consequences will primarily be born in Israel. And Israelis have an intimate familiarity with all these issues in a way that those who are not living in Israel and have not been living in Israel for decades will not get. You can't get this from a 3-minute clip on YouTube. And the criticisms coming from outside, the interference coming from outside, is having significant adverse effects on the country. And I don't mean just on the debate. I mean primarily outside of the debate about judicial reform. So perhaps this is a moment to take a step back and admit that maybe we've misunderstood what's going on, and let's withhold our opinions until we see how things develop.
Great. Avi, I want to thank you for everything and taking the time and unpacking all of this. There is it is depressing, you know, on a variety of issues, and there's a lot to look at. But I appreciate you taking and explaining your side, your involvement and explaining, where things are. It's useful for all of us here that trying to understand and comprehend what is going on. So really, thank you for taking the time to talk to us this afternoon. I want to thank everybody who came this afternoon to join us. I know there are more questions we did not get to. I apologize for that. Please feel free to email us at bdsmonitor@spme.org, and we will do our best to respond in a timely fashion. I want to thank, as always, Alex for joining me this afternoon, and of course you, Avi. I know it's already nighttime for you, and the noise of the kids and everybody is ready for bedtime shortly. And hopefully we can bring you back at a later time. We can, as this debate continues and continue the conversation.
Thank you very, very much. I want to apologize for the technical difficulties and for the human difficulty of the noise, but thank you very much for the opportunity.
Great. Thank you as always. Have a good evening. Have a good day, everybody, and we will talk soon.